Hello and welcome, you're listening to the Kres Files podcast with Mr. Kres and Garth. It is Thursday the 25th of September 2014. If folks out there would like to get this podcast, you can get it from iTunes, so download and subscribe there. The podcast is also available from Podomatic, which is a great podcasting site, so go to podomatic.com and search for the Kres Files podcast. And you can also get the podcast from Spreaker.com. You can send us an email to thekrasfiles@yahoo.com.au, and you can log on to thekrasfiles.com, which is a link site we set up. So plenty of stories going up there, and that is always C-R-A-Z-Z for Kres. Okay, hello, thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Kres Files podcast with Mr. Kres and Garth, and we have a very special guest joining us from the United States today for a conversation. It's Tom Goodforth. How are you going, Tom?
Hey, how are you doing, Adam?
Hello, Tom, it's Garth here.
And you too, Garth, how are you? It's a good morning there, I hope.
Yeah, it's a bit wet here. We're getting a bit of a rain, but that's great. We need it.
Yeah.
But, so how are you?
I'm very good, and as far as rain, we're getting it here in Florida, too, so maybe we're having the same storm front move through as Australia's. I don't think so, but very good. Thank you both.
Okay.
Well, it's great to have you, and thanks for joining us here, and we're going to go through your fantastic book today and have a chat with you, and it's great for you to come on and chat with us. It really shows you're such a fantastic guy, and I've been chatting with you in email, and you're only too eager to help out and spread this amazing information. And Garth and I have got your fantastic book, which is Hellstorm, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Why don't we talk about your biography here, Tom? What do you reckon?
Okay.
You're Thomas Goodrich?
Goodrich. I was actually born Michael Thomas Schoenlein. And it's very German, of course, but I was adopted soon after birth, and now I'm Michael Thomas Goodrich. Sound very Scottish, I suppose, or Scotch-Irish, but no, I'm mostly German and French, and some Italian thrown in there.
Oh, it's great, and I have a look at your bio here. It says you've been around, and you're also interested in painting watercolors. Which Garth does himself. He does a lot of painting up there on the property. And he does also other sick stuff, Tom, like planting trees and growing fruit. I don't know why he's doing that. I think he's a terrorist. But Garth likes to get out there and be a terrorist and paint watercolors as well as you do. And you said that
the poor man. Yeah. I just barely survived at my painting. I was painting for 2 years, and you've heard the term, the expression starving artist. That originated with me because it was a pretty difficult sell, quite honestly.
Well, watercolors, I love watercolors, but I'm not very good at it. I stick to oils because you can make a lot of mistakes and fix them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
whereas with watercolor, mm-hmm. You've got to be pretty intense. You've got to know what you're doing, yeah. You know, to make it work. You can't. Once it's on, that's it.
Do you know what I did? Garth, you know what my technique was? I actually used tubes of watercolor. But what I would do would only add a very small amount of water, and I treated them very much like oils or acrylics, and I would sometimes glop them on, and they dried very quickly. There was no nasty mess. There was no resin to use to clean up your oily mess, and so it dried quickly. It had a very pleasant look to it, and people bought them, quite honestly. I didn't make enough to get rich, but I did make some money, and I painted when I was on the coast of America up in Maine, New England, for a couple of years. Seascapes, lighthouses, seagulls, things like that.
Yes.
Seems a really beautiful place,
yes.
Tom,
mm.
Maine. Is it very beautiful place there?
Yes, it is. Rocky coast, beautiful blue-green water. It can be very cold there, of course. You guys are not used to that, but it's, in fact, two of the most grim winters I've ever spent in my life were in Maine. It just seemed to never stop from September to May, and that was the snow season.
September to May, was it?
Yes, that's for 2 years, September through May.
Goodness gracious. Expect,
yeah, snow on the ground.
Yeah, very interesting. Yes, that'd be because we have a very short winter here. It's only a couple of months, really.
I've never gone to Australia. I've never been there. I would love to go there, of course, but I suppose I have to wait for a reason to go. I don't know why I've never been there. It could be I'll be there within a year or two now because I'm working on a book, a parallel book to the book we're going to talk about here tonight. It's about the atrocities committed against Japan. And I know Australians, I know what most Australians probably think, the dirty Jap bastards got what they deserved. It's probably, well, it's the way it's thought in America. But I got to tell you, the things that we did, the Americans, wow. And my biological father fought in the Pacific. He was a Marine island hopping from, you know, toward Japan. You know the story better than me, probably. And so and my adoptive father fought in Europe. So I've got fathers fighting on both ends of the earth here. And I know the element I grew up in, that Japanese were animals, they were monkeys and trees, they were beasts, they were meant to be slaughtered, they were meant to be shot down. Or even, for instance, some of the American movies are almost sadistic in the way they enjoy killing the Japs, the dirty Japs. And so just like with my German book, I thought, man, you know, these Japs can't be all bad. They can't be they built a pretty nice society, actually, a very powerful country, so they can't be all animalistic. So that was sort of the premise I went that I used in approaching this book. Again, it's going to be a pretty grim. Let me put it to you this way. How many Japanese concentration camps have you ever seen? I'm talking about the American camps where there are Japanese prisoners behind the barbed wire. Very few until the Americans finally occupied Japan and huge numbers of soldiers, of course, surrendered with the armistice. But prior to that, Americans were just simply taking no prisoners. They were killing every Jap that came forward. The common thought is that Japanese fought until the end. They fought for the emperor. It was very embarrassing to surrender or dishonorable. And that may be true, but I guarantee you a lot of Japanese wanted to live. I've read their diaries. They wanted to go on living. And if they could surrender and go on living and go back and marry that cute girl that they were planning on marrying, they would do that. But there was simply no quarter on the islands. Americans were killing them, shooting them. Like I said, the aspect of this book that's so difficult right now is finding eyewitness accounts of those Japanese soldiers, sailors, airmen who survived to tell what they went through. I can find virtually none. And so that's what I mean by I may end up in Japan and China in the next year or so because I do have some friends there who are probably willing to help me translate. If there are any diaries there to translate of these survivors. Mm. Otherwise, I don't know how I can finish this book because unlike the German book that we're talking about tonight, there were a number who survived after to leave diaries and memoirs and letters and to talk about it. Not as many as I would have hoped, but there were still after the so-called armistice in May of 1945, there were millions of Germans that somehow managed to survive. And so it made writing a book much easier for someone like myself.
And this book, Tom, is Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947, by Thomas Goodrich. And people can get that from Amazon, Garth, and I just bought the Kindle version, which is $9.55 here in Australia. And it's amazing, Tom. You've written a whole bunch of books as mm-hmm, well. Yeah. The Darkest Dawn, Lincoln, Booth, and the Great American Tragedy, Bloody Dawn, the story of the Lawrence Massacre, whole bunch on Indian warfare and the High Plains. So a whole bunch there that you've done. But this book, Hellstorm, is obviously your newest book. And I understand it's not going to be an easy read for a lot of people. I've already started. I understand that. But as I said to you before the start of the podcast, I think it's positive. And I think it's, from what I've already read, one of the most important books that I've ever read. And I think Garth would agree because we're brought up our entire lives to believe something else. an absolute false reality in what they're doing in our schools and universities, and this whole Holocaust nonsense. We're made to constantly feel sorry and sympathetic for the Jewish people because of what Hitler did to them and all this nonsense, and no one's told the truth, and we need to grow a set of balls, Tom, and we need to start manning up, and we need to start reading books like this and understanding what happened in our past, because you look at human life, Tom, and it's only so short, you know. You look at a glacier or a tree that's thousands of years old. We're here maybe 70, 90 years if we're lucky. It's only a drop in time, and this didn't happen that long ago when you look at it, and it was absolutely barbaric, and it's such an important book, Hellstorm, and such a perfect name for this book as well. I can't think of a better name for that book. So why don't you start us off, Tom, about this terrible tragedy that happened in Germany at that time?
Very well put, Adam. In my opinion, this book reveals the darkest and best-kept secret in world history. This is the first book in 70 years since the war is over that actually tells what really occurred during that last year of war and the immediate post-war years. And there has never been anything like it. And the title, Hellstorm, was the best I could come up with. Because
it's perfect, yes.
Frankly, the English language, as colorful and descriptive as it can be, is not descriptive enough. There's nothing to describe what occurred to Germany from 1944 to 1947. Certainly not Holocaust. Certainly not genocide. Hellstorm, a storm from hell, is the best I could come up with because, well, quite honestly, never in history have so many people been murdered. Never in history have so many people been raped. Never in history have so many people been tortured. And yet, Adam and Garth, never in history have so few people known about this. It's the darkest and best kept secret in world history. The actual crimes committed against Germany are so fiendish, so hideous, so total, so encompassing that they just beggar description.
It's hard.
But you know, the cover up. The cover-up these last 70 years, that's a crime almost equally as great.
Oh,
in my opinion.
Shocking.
But that's what happens when you own the power of communication, when it's in your grip. The Jewish grip, for the last 100 years, it's been a stranglehold on communications. That's where we got all of our information. Back in the bad old days when the dead tree media was the only news we had, we read those newspapers and we believed those newspapers because that's the way we were taught. Then when radio came along, our grandfathers and fathers, they listened to this. And yeah, it was true, they said. I mean, because who would lie to us on the radio? TV comes along, the same thing. It's even worse. Our children sit in front of that thing, become indoctrinated, watching these war movies, and they believe these things. But now that's ending thanks to people just exactly like yourself. We're circumventing this stranglehold that's been in place for the last 100 years. Now the truth is finally coming out. It's people like you that are allowing the truth to come out by having people like me on. Thank you again, you guys, for the great introduction, and thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate this. But anyway, back to the story itself. There's a number of components. In fact, a lot of writers, intrepid, wonderful writers, have spoken about various aspects of this enormous dark crime that was committed against Germany. And bless their hearts, I mean, they've done a wonderful job. People like David Irving with the destruction of Dresden. Other people have written about, for instance, the dislocation, the forced removal of the Germans at the end of the war, this fiendish, diabolical attempt to just disenfranchise the Germans, cast them to the wind, and if they live, they live. If they died, so what? It's forced removal of roughly 11 million Germans and the consequent death of 1 to 2 million who didn't succeed in getting away. People have written about these aspects or the firebombing of Germany, but I'm the only person, the only author, the only historian, and this is the only book that tries to bring it all together to see just what the average German in the street was facing. This book is told in the words of the people themselves. This is not me. You know, it's really easy, as they say, to kill the messenger. But to kill a message, a lot of folks, especially it's a great Jewish tactic, to kill a messenger, call them names, and denigrate them, vilify them, and try to destroy the message that way. Well, guess what? This is the book that's in the words of the people themselves. It's pretty damned hard to disagree with somebody who watched their child running through the streets like a living torch after an American firebombing raid. It's difficult to question a woman's motive when she talks about being raped 50 times in one night by a bunch of Russians or a bunch of Americans. When these people are doing the talking themselves, these are words you can't refuse to understand or empathize with. Whereas I'm just the vehicle. This book is just the mechanism for allowing these people to have a say. In fact, the book is dedicated to the voiceless victims of the world's worst war. That's the way I dedicated it, because these people never had anybody, news people, telling the world about what happened to them. And they didn't have anybody crying over their graves after the war was over and holding ceremonies and raising monuments to their memory. And so this is the best we can do right now. It's just a very, it's not such a small book, but it's a very modest book, I would say. The crimes committed against Germany. The book, let me basically tell you the way the book starts off. It starts off with... it starts off initially with the first Red invasion of Germany in the autumn of 1944. It talks about the ghastly, the vindictive propaganda war that's been waged against Germany by the Jewish-controlled media throughout the world, in America, Australia, of course, and England, and other European countries. The first Russian incursion into Prussia in 1944 was a brief thing. The Russians came in and held roughly 3 miles of Prussian territory for about a day or two, and then they were driven out by a German counteroffensive. But what the Germans found when they came in was just horrifying. They had never seen anything like this. Virtually nobody was there. There was no one alive in this area around Nemersdorf. What was there, however, are some sights right out of hell. Women who had been raped, nailed to barn doors, crucified on wagons, old people with their heads blown off, men who had tried to protect their wives and daughters from rape were actually literally sawed in half, sawed right through the belly in half, children in rows, dead, entire treks or cavalcades or refugees trying to escape the Russians, flattened like squirrels in the road by the tanks that had driven right over them, flattening them. These are the sites that met the first Germans when they made their counterattack. And after a while, the German authorities called in the some representatives from neutral countries, Sweden and Switzerland and Spain, and asked them to look at this. See, this is what we're fighting against. We're fighting against animals. And The hope was, of course, that they would spread this news to the world and there'd be such outrage that it would never happen again. But nothing happened.
Covered up.
By that late date of the war, 1944, the world really didn't give a damn about Germans. They didn't care about brained babies or raped women or old people with their heads blown off or men sawed in half. Nope, they cared about the plight of the Jews in the so-called death camps, because that's what was going on right now with the propaganda, the plight of the poor Jews. So really, Germans were on their own. You could do anything you wanted to Germans, and of course the Americans, British, French, and Russians did. The Allied terror bombing, I'd never experienced anything like this from my research. I never really truly understood what the terror bombing was like. I had watched the old movies just like you guys, the bombs flying down, the towns lighting up, and it looked pretty terrible, but it was only when I started doing the research that I understood the methodology late in the war of the Americans and British for dealing with German cities. Cities of a population of anywhere from 25,000 up, these 1,000 plane raids where they would come in, the RAF would come in at night and blow a town to bits, just destroying it. Don't forget, a lot of Germany was in the old medieval wooden style. That beautiful, you've seen pictures of them, beautiful wood buildings. And so when you bombed a building or a city like that, there's a lot of wood, a lot of splinters. So after blowing a city to atoms like that, then the Americans or the British would return a day later, a few hours later, whatever, and drop tons upon tons of incendiary bombs, napalm we call it today, but to ignite this wood, this structures that have been blown apart, to ignite them. And the fires created by these fire bombings were just incredible. In fact, the temperatures, I think they said, were something like 3,000 degrees in the center of these firestorms. They were so intense, and as a matter of fact, that tornadoes actually rose up. Incredible fiery vortexes rose 3 miles into the sky. It would be something just right out of the pages of hell to see something like this. But those poor individuals who had survived the initial raid, the blasting part of their cities, who had managed to escape their shelters, and believe me, many thousands did not escape. Those who got out, that's what they had to face, was this new raid, firestorms. In other words, they were trapped mostly, and they could not get out. People did everything they could to escape the fires, but the heat was so intense that many people were actually stuck like glue into the asphalt and would simply burn to death right there. Others who tried to jump in canals or rivers, you still had to come up to breathe, and you would come up into the 2,000 and 3,000 degree heat, and you could imagine you're not going to survive that. You're going to blister, and your lungs will blister, and then you'll burst into flames. So, I've read, you know, the terror bombing, this fire bombings that are going on, and this was occurring in every German city, not just Dresden. Dresden is the most famous incident of this. It's been well known because of people like David Irving who have written about it, but virtually every German city went through a similar process of firebombing. I suppose it's because there is a feeling among the victorious Allies in later years, and even to this very day, that, wow, what we did was really a major, major world crime, incinerating men, women, and children. And by the way, mostly women and children, because you know where the men were at the time. They were off fighting a two-war front, actually a three-war front in Italy also. So this was mostly old people, women, and children that were incinerated in these firestorms. But there's been a move to minimize the impact of the Allied terror bombing by diminishing the numbers that are supposedly killed in these raids. Dresden's the most common example. Today, there's people talking about Dresden was truly a terrible thing. We agree. But at most, it was only 25 or 35,000 people that died in Dresden. And they know damn good and well when they're saying that this is an egregious lie. They know, as I know, that Dresden was already a city of roughly 500,000 people, but it was enhanced or augmented by refugees fleeing the Soviets to the east by another 500,000 to 600,000 refugees, mostly women and children and old people. So we've got a very small city center, relatively speaking, jammed, crammed with anywhere from 800,000 to 1 million people in that downtown old city area. And now Dresden had not even been touched throughout the war. Suddenly, on a night in early 1945, the British come in with an enormous raid, and they catch these people in the middle of Mardi Gras. It's called Fasching in Germany, but it's actually a Mardi Gras revelry type of thing where people dress in costumes and try to have a little fun in the midst of war. Well, they caught people, some of the townspeople going to events, and then they caught the refugees where they had been for weeks, in the alleys, in the streets, in the parks, down by the railroad station, huddled in their little on their bundles, and their children crying for food. Caught all these people in the middle of the city, and the blasts, of course, killed them by the tens of thousands, because it was literally killing ducks in a barrel. But later that night, of course, in come the Americans and the British again with firebombs. And that's the story that David Irving describes so well in his book. There's no war to it. There's nothing military about this. It's a sadistic massacre, as simple as I can make it. Stalin wanted the Allies to give him an example of their loyalty, I think, to the Allied compact, the powers, he wanted proof that they were going to help the Russian invasion of Germany. And this was it, supposedly, killing anywhere from the estimates, in my opinion, are, and this is the International Red Cross and German authorities themselves, anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000 people died in the day and night of bombing of Dresden. Now, what was in store for a lot of the people who somehow managed to survive this incredible firestorm the next day when they sought shelter in the park along the Elbe River and tried to get out of town. Well, guess what? It's a very clear day. The smoke is pretty much diminished from the night before. But in come the American fighter pilots and their Mustang aircraft strafing the people in the parks, shooting them as they're running, shooting them down with machine guns and cannon fire. There is no mistaking who these people are. You can see them. It's really easy. You can see the pilots' faces as they go by you. You can see who you're shooting. There's a child there. There's a woman there. Shoot them. Kill them. Blow them apart. Even the animals in the zoos that had escaped, the keepers had let them out because of the firestorm. Even these animals didn't survive. The Americans are shooting these animals. One zookeeper said he actually cried when this brave American actually shot their last giraffe. That's a kind of war. That's not the war we were taught was fought in Germany. We've got this idea that this was the good war. This was the greatest generation. And I think this book, if it doesn't do anything else, just blows that notion all to hell. This wasn't a good war. It was the worst war, and these weren't the greatest generation. They wasn't even the good generation. They were the worst generation in American history that could go over and commit crimes like this. But anyway, Allied terror bombing is just one aspect of the book. And before I get off this, let me describe something else, because it may be as novel and new to you as it was to me while I was doing the research for the book. I'd never heard of it. But there was also a policy, a very nice-sounding policy by the RAF and the American 8th Air Force. It was called Targets of Opportunity. That's basically turning your fighter pilots loose on Germany and shooting anything that moves. It's up to them. It's an early form of video game, let's put it that way, where you can put some jerk off up in a pilot seat and let him basically have the sadistic pleasure of shooting anything that moves. And many of them lived up to that with aces and spades. Women on their bicycles shot at. Trains filled with refugees blown to bits by these pilots strafing. Canal barges filled with people. Even schoolyards with kids playing in them. Farmers in the fields. There are animals in the fields. These are all targets and all are shot. So in other words, everything that moves in Germany is a target. Day or night, as a consequence, I want to point this out too while we're on it. As a consequence, in the last months of the war, virtually nothing was moving. Nothing was happening. Food was very short. Medicine was in short supply. The concentration camps, the so-called death camps, they were getting virtually nothing because the German people themselves in the cities and villages were getting much, much less than they ever had because of this terrific pressure on anything that moved. I mean, you face it, in Australia, you just stop every truck and stop every boat and stop every train and see how long you can stay fed. You won't be fed very long, I'm going to tell you that. Your medicine will be gone real quick, too. And the same thing happened to Germany. And so you've got this total shutdown of movement in Germany. Yes, those concentration camps where the Americans and British and Russians finally broke in, there were lots of dead bodies there, but a lot of dead bodies from dehydration, from the diseases, the epidemics that were just running rampant through these camps, and people were stacked like cordwood. That's right. That's what happens to any nation when they have no movement, no transportation, when everything has been closed down, no food, no medicine. But anyway, do you guys have any questions? I could ramble on and on here.
Oh no, it's fine, Tom. For me, I'm just interested in what you're saying. I was just from your Red Ice interview, you brought up some things there as well, which I found very interesting. You know, particularly with the way the Jews are going on about the Holocaust, and when that Eich came in, and he was they put him in for that reason because he already established how he hated Germans. and that was recorded. And when he killed, I think it was up to 1.5 million innocent people, he allowed them to die. Yeah. That's something I think, you know, for people to understand, because Ike was given a big name, particularly in this country, and people revered him. Mm-hmm. But when you see what sort of a man he was, well, he wasn't a man. He was, I don't think he was a human being.
Parasites.
Well, if you can give us some information on that as well, you know, on Ike, because I've read a bit about Ike, and it's disturbed me what type, because Ike was a Jew, and a lot of people don't know that, but he was Jewish. So
you know, I grew up loving Eisenhower, and so it was a double blow for me because I grew up in the same state that he grew up in, Kansas. He was born in Texas, but he grew up in Kansas. And Kansas is a rather small state, in case you don't know. It's as far as population. So you feel closeness to somebody else who becomes a great, supposedly great general, supreme commander, then American president. I like Ike. That was what he ran on. My parents were solid Republicans, loved Eisenhower. So you can imagine how I must have felt when I found out that this guy was one of the worst mass murderers in history. He was a desk general. He was a commissar. He never heard a bullet fired in anger. He was in his position simply because he could take orders and dish it out, so to speak, dish it out. He was more like a Jewish commissar in the Russian army. In other words, he was there to provide backbone, vindictive backbone to his subalterns, the soldiers underneath him. But yes, it seems like the most bloodthirsty are the ones furthest removed from the front. And Eisenhower is a clear case, a clear example. Because after the war was over, Eisenhower, the ones that he didn't have a chance for his men to kill, he rounded them up and basically put them in these concentration camps. Now that the war was over, the risk of Germans retaliating against American prisoners was over because they had all been released. And by the way, 99% of the Americans, according to the Red Cross, returned home in great health in German prison camps. 99%, that's a better average than had they all been back in America at the time. Mm. Some of them would have been killed in car wrecks and accidents. So 99%, whereas Eisenhower could not wait to get these people, the Germans, into his concentration camps, clearly. But still, with the eyes of the world watching, there still was the Geneva Convention about the treatment of prisoners of war. Well, Eisenhower circumvented that nicely by simply calling them disarmed enemy combatants, a new name nomenclature to basically justify what he did, and that's killing them by the hundreds of thousands. Yeah, an estimate of anywhere from 800,000 to 1.5 million helpless, disarmed, honorable German soldiers were allowed to die from starvation, from dehydration, from the elements, from neglect, from outright murder. And this wasn't because of chaotic conditions. This wasn't for lack of organization. The American Army was very well organized. And it wasn't for lack of food. The International Red Cross offered many times to bring in trainloads of food to help feed these dying prisoners who are dying by the tens of thousands every day. Eisenhower forbade it. He would not let them come in. His mission was to kill as many as he possibly could. Even though the Rhine River ran by several of these camps, he would not allow anyone to get water from the river. They would die of thirst until they had to drink their own urine. And many of the men were so sick that they could not even crawl out of their pathetic dugouts, the dirt dugouts that they had, since they didn't get any roof over their head, they tried to create their own. Many of them were so sick they could not even come out of there, and so they were just merely bulldozed over while still alive, the American bulldozers. That is one of the most terrible crimes. Well, can you imagine what other nation would elevate to American presidency a war criminal, a murderer? And I've got to believe that many, many thousands of Americans over there knew what he was doing. This isn't something you could keep secret. This is millions of German, helpless German POWs are in these camps. Hundreds of thousands of American soldiers are there. many, many people would have known, and yet it took a Canadian, I believe, James Bach, to report about the death camps of Eisenhower, and that's where I got my information. But the fact that we would elevate Eisenhower, and to this very day, honor him, may show where America's priorities are. They're with truly, this isn't America is not the country I grew up believing in. Perhaps I was naive. Perhaps I
doesn't matter, Tom. Look at Benjamin Netanyahu. How many standing ovations did he get in the American Congress? I mean, parasite, and still going today as it was then. It's still the same system and the same mindset today as it was then, which is even more frightening. And as we've said, this can happen again, very much so. The only difference will be that it'll be more technical, you know. So it's still going on. That's the thing, you know. They're still worshipping these men, and I can't. It's just like the whole world's hypnotized.
Well, when you have a look at the leaders in Israel, going right back from 1948 and the terrors there, when they what they did to the Palestinians, and they ended up in control of Israel. It seems to be a pattern with the Jews for some reason.
It's the same mindset. And even this time, we're like, we do a lot of research here on the Catholic Church and the molestation of children, including the popes and the Ninth Circle. There was all these graves dug up in Canada of Mohawkie Indigenous children. They, with penetrating radar, satellite radar, they found these graves. And that was set up by the Queen of England and the Pope. And they raped and tortured these children. And the Ninth Circle, we found out, is something the popes participate in, where they kill babies and drink their blood. And this is mainstream news. I mean, everybody knows what they're doing. This is, and they're saying that it happened, this satanic kind of dark infiltration of the Catholic Church happened around World War II with this same mindset. And we're seeing the same mindset today in Palestine with these Jewish people sitting up there on sofas eating popcorn, watching these children and women being blown to bits. And we had these Israeli officials come out and say, well, one way to stop the Palestinians would be to rape their women. And he meant rape and torture all their women, from young girls to grandmothers. So again, the same mindset right through history, today and then. It's the same, and that's what I'm looking at your book as well, the mindset behind what these people did. Because these soldiers went in and did, as you said on Red Eyes, they're just young, dumb. I guess they're full of cum, Tom. And they just go in and they follow their orders. But the men, the Jewish leaders, these shadowy figures who have always been there, gave these orders to do these atrocities. And some of it's just so hard to read. These soldiers went and did it, Americans as well, and it's just horrifying. But this lineage, this shadowy line of people are still here today, and they were back then, right through history. And this is the same mindset, isn't it, Tom?
Yes. You know, sometimes I get very despondent when I, you know, we were raised as Christians or Protestants, and we've heard of heaven, we've heard of hell. And I sometimes think, you know, I don't have to die to go to hell. I'm living in hell. This is hell. Hmm. Maybe when we die, we all go to heaven, or maybe we don't go anywhere. But how many more terrible things can we possibly do to ourselves and everything around us? It's as if we become devils, all of us, because when I think about the things done in this book, Hellstorm, what could make ordinary Americans and British and Aussies and Russian boys, what could make them do such terrible things as are chronicled in this book? I understand propaganda. I was young once, too. I was in the military, and I know what propaganda is all about, but I still think I had a conscience in place. I still think I would have obeyed myself and not listened to propaganda. But how? But obviously, I was in a minority, because you could not commit this many atrocities. And I agree with you. The atrocities have not stopped with World War II. It's continuing all the way to this day. In other words, sometimes I actually think this world would be better off if we did get into World War III and we did destroy it, because it seems like there is no end to the horror. Now, that said, that's why we're on a program like this tonight, all of us talking, because we do think we could pulled out of this. We think we have We can make a difference. We can stop some of this. If enough people know, or if enough good people know, the masses will never come around. I've got to tell you guys this. But if we can find enough good people to come around, we will have done our job. But I agree with you.
Is it,
for instance...
Yeah, it's hard, Tom. I don't know where those soldiers got the idea for those atrocities. I mean, some of the ideas that you say in your book, even earlier on the book, nailing naked women after raping them to barn doors with hammers and nails. I mean, yes, some of this stuff, where did they come up with this mindset to do that to human beings?
You know? I'll tell you right now where some of it came from. And before we go any further, I want the listeners to keep in mind that we're not making this stuff up as we go along. These guys, Adam and Garth, have read parts of the book or getting through the book, and I've, of course, lived the book. These are the people themselves that are telling us. These are from the eyewitness accounts of people who saw this or sometimes were the victims of it or even the victimizers of it. So as ghastly, as horrific, as vile as these crimes are, they happened. Alas, unfortunately, but they happened. And let's go back. You say, how do young 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old young men get into the frame of mind where they can do such vicious things? Well, there was Stalin's right-hand man, the minister of propaganda, was a Jew named Ilya Ehrenberg. And this man, of course, hated Germans to the depth of his being. And when the scale started tipping against Germany and the Soviets were actually ready to invade Germany in late 1944, Ilya Ehrenberg started pinning these ghastly, vicious diatribes against Germans. He would have these printed up on flyers that could be dropped out of airplanes onto the soldiers below, the red soldiers. These encouragement for the red soldiers to do their wicked worst. Things like, basically, I'll try to quote one, soldiers of the Red Army, no German is guiltless, whether he be a living or yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German women. Take her for your legitimate property. Rape her. Play with her. But after you're through with her, kill her. Nothing in Germany is guiltless. Kill them all, my beautiful red soldiers. Kill everything. This is just one example. He had hundreds of them. But these are messages that are being given to these rough, crude peasant boys from Russia. Very unsophisticated, very ignorant. Don't forget, Russia for the past 40, 50 years have been bled white by Jewish Bolshevism. And so you've got a very ignorant proletariat. And these soldiers read this, and what do you think they think? They think that, wow, that we've been fighting the Germans all this time. They've ran through our country. They've burned our villages. Yes, I already hate them, but now I have proof in front of me that I can do anything I want when I get into Germany and there will be no punishment. Right here, Stalin's Ministry of Propaganda says I can. I can rape, I can steal, I can burn, I can do all the devilish things I've only thought about doing. That's obviously what a lot of Red soldiers thought, because that's exactly what they did. When they got in there, well, hell was released on earth. Now, I should say this. Beginning from beginning roughly all the way through at least three-fourths of the book, the rape is one of the common components that occur throughout, because it occurred throughout this period, 1944 to 1947, the later stages of the war, or in the later stages of the timeline, that is, from 1946-47, rape was replaced mostly by a candy bar, a Hershey bar, or bacon and eggs, or silk stockings. In other words, the soldiers in occupation could actually buy any German they wanted for a token. But during the war itself, rape was pervasive on both sides, the East and the West side. Russians committed rape, Americans committed rape, the British committed rape, not to the degree, however, of the Americans and Russians. But one of the ugliest aspects of the book is this business of rape, the spiritual massacre of German womanhood.
And it's a Jewish idea too, Tom.
Yes, and I should say that, yes, it is, because the Jewish commissars that traveled with virtually every Russian military unit that above company level to make sure that the soldiers obeyed and were good little communists and aided and killed the Germans with Soviet, you know, with all the Soviet hatred they could muster. They were always there. And, of course, they encouraged these men. Let me say this. The frontline soldiers, composed largely of white Russians, Belarus, Ukrainians, these were the shock troops. These were the great troops. These were the good troops. They were very tough, and they certainly committed their own share of crimes. But for the most part, according to the eyewitness accounts, they were far too busy worrying about survival to worry about things like rape or arson or murder or even theft. They were too busy worrying about staying alive and survival, tripping from door to door, looking for Germans in these buildings or that building as they crept forward toward Germany. Whereas the second, the rear echelon troops, the troops who came in right behind the front line, say 2 or 3 hours later, these were composed largely of Asiatics, or Mongolians, Kulaks, people like that, from the far eastern zones of the Soviet Union. These people were the devils from hell, quite honestly. Not me saying it. That's what the victims say. That's what the Russian officers themselves say. They would, in fact, with stone-like faces, look at the Germans and say, you go quick. We fighting men. The ones that are following us, these are animals. They will show you no mercy. You go quick. Well, of course, a lot of people tried to go quick, but they couldn't. Others, there was nothing they could do but stay and wait. But as soon as these Mongolian invaders roared into town on top of their trucks, and driving their wagons and actually leading their herds of cattle and sheep, it was like a medieval invasion. Hell on earth was released in these towns because one of the first things they did, of course, was find things to drink, everything from liquor, fine liquor, to perfume and gasoline. They'd drink anything. They went were nuts for it. And then, of course, after that, the fires and the shooting, they were killing virtually anyone they wanted to kill. But then they turned to rape. And rape, we've got a fairly puritanical notion of rape, if that's possible. We see one woman being raped by one man generally, and that's it. It's terrible. It's awful. She's violated. And hopefully the son of a bitch who did it is brought to justice and serves, you know, at least 10 days in jail in America, maybe more, I suppose. But I'm being facetious. But this is not it. This is gang rape. This is sanctified, vicious gang rape where a line will actually form to rape one woman after another, and there was nothing that could protect these women. From 8 to 80, that was the age range. 8 years old, which is a child by anybody's standards, to 80, which is someone with both feet in the grave, more or less. But these are the age groups that were could be expect to be raped, with men standing in line to rape them. Violent, vicious rape. A woman, in fact, for a woman to be raped 20, 30, 40, even 50 times a night was not out of the question. Hundreds of times a week. It just depended on how long the Mongolian, Asiatic, Soviet soldiers were there. Whether it's a few hours or maybe a few weeks, depending on the fighting up front. But, you know, it's we've got this idea that rape is just about vaginal and penis rape, penile rape. Sometimes it's way out there. That's the least of the problems a woman faced. It was so ugly and vicious and so slimy and filthy. It's not even worth talking about right now. I do mention some of the stuff in the book, but it's, well, for instance, no, I'm not even going to go there. I'm just going to say that it was, well, okay. Things like with the Jewish commissars, they loved to force the men folk, the Germans, that is, the men, to watch the women being raped. It was one of the thrills they got. It was one of the passions. It was not only breaking the racial pride of both the men and the women, but it was good entertainment, good theater. And so one sure way to get a great audience would be to, he knew that, let's say I'm a Jew and a Jewish commissar, I know instinctively that when we roll into a town, most of the women are going to flee to the church. They're going to think that that's a sanctuary. They're going to think that we're going to respect that. Well, guess what, guys? That's the first place we're stopping. I'm taking these dirty, muddy, filthy animals in there, and we're going to rape every woman, every child, every nun, and if a priest gets in the way, or even if he doesn't get in the way, we'll nail him up and crucify him on the church wall. This time and time again happened. In fact, one of my sources for this, and when I say time and time again, I don't mean just here, there, gone, it happened real quick. No, I'm talking about up and down Eastern Germany, Prussia, down to Silesia, down to Bavaria, all the way through there. This is going on, massive, millions of rapes, millions of women raped, millions of times. One of the sickest aspects of the rape that are occurring is this beastly need to inflict as much pain and hurt and suffering on these women as possible. And when that's not possible anymore, when they finally raped a woman to death, to continue to rape her. In fact, time and time and time again, there are accounts of men in broad daylight standing in line on a street to rape a dead woman. One after another, laughing about it. I'm not making this up. The people themselves talk about it. The priests talk about it. The survivors.
This is what the elites do, Tom. Jimmy Savile did it. Still happening today. That's what they do. And, yeah.
And when when the woman turns stiff as a board, then you stick something up her vagina, signifying business is, the business is closed for the day type of thing. That's so far out there that it's
an absolute hatred, isn't it, Tom? Absolute hatred. Yeah.
The depth of hatred.
It's
and
even
depravity,
beyond that. Yeah.
It's the closest I've ever been to hell or to Satan or devils. I'll be very honest with you guys, and I may lose a lot of listeners right now turning off, but I'm not religious. I would like to think of a hereafter, a better life. I suppose you would call me an atheist. I just don't buy into it because I don't see how any God could allow things like this I'm talking about or modern things that we've been talking about earlier tonight. I don't see how. Well, I'll tell you what, he's certainly no God I want to be any part of that could allow this to go on. So therefore, I think I'm in hell. I think we've all been cast into hell, and this is part of it right now. It's not burning to death in furnaces. It's being forced to watch this. It's being forced to have a soul and watch and suffer through this stuff. But anyway, the rapes, it's another thing all of its own. And you know something? There's not one monument that I know of anywhere in the world dedicated to the women that were raped. There should be. I've seen something. I believe the Poles tried to put up a monument at one time, a monument to the women that were raped. But it was taken down, torn down. I think this is before the Iron Curtain came down. And, all the women I talked to researching this book, actually who were still alive in their 80s, of course, not one woman admitted that she was raped. Not one woman. As you can imagine, there was no levity in these interviews I did with these women, these men and women. There was no levity. There was no humor. If they smiled, it was a faint smile. It wasn't like an Australian smile or an American smile. We have never gone through anything like this, so we still know how to smile. The Germans stopped smiling after this war. Became a very dead place. I get off. Are there any questions, you guys? Because I just go on and on.
It's highly necessary, Tom. And as the Jews know, rape is a weapon, and it's not just, as you said, vaginal and rape. But look at what the Jews are doing today with pornography; they're normalizing it. All these disgusting pornography films that all these young men are watching with these 18-year-old girls, pretty much getting raped and gang raped, and they're watching this on their smartphones now. They've never had such easy access, and these men are now looking at women that way, and that's normal. So You know, it's what you said before about these soldiers being given free rein, you know, just to do whatever they wanted inside Germany. The scary thing to ask yourself is, if the government did that today, how many people would do that still? You know, it's a scary thing, and but it absolutely, I would say it almost takes their soul, and it just shatters their entire life, and they're never going to be the same again. And the Jews knew that, and that's why they used rape as a weapon. But we're being indoctrinated to think that this type of stuff is normal now through this Jewish pornography, in particular. You know,
but it's a breakdown of the, isn't it? It's a breakdown by attacking the women.
It's an absolute breakdown all the way down the line. Yep. Yeah.
Well, yeah, how does a woman, let's say a woman survives these 100 rapes a week, 20, 30, 40 a night, survives 2 weeks. Yeah. How does she go on living after that? I mean, what the hell do you do? Yeah. I'll tell you what, I was raped as a child. I went through, for about 2 years, something similar to this. But let me get this straight, not to the degree, not to the enormity of this, but how does a person, a human being, carry on with life after they've been dragged through hell like this, to be in front of the village, in front of their children and husband and family, in front of the entire town, or like I've used this example before, a school teacher forced to do filthy things to these people in front of her students. How do you get back to being normal? How do you continue with life? So in other words, even the women who were not killed, they're virtually dead, spiritually massacred. And there's just not much more they're going to do in life. I'm going to tell you that. They might go through the motions. They might bake some bread. They might even bear a few children after that. I doubt it. But I've got to believe the suicides in Germany after the war and for the next few decades were just off the charts. I have to believe that because you could not, at least I could not survive after passing through this. But the point is, that there were many ways to wage war on the Germans, and this was one of them.
Why was this done, Tom? Why was this done to the German people? I know at the start of your book you talk about that town. It's so creepy how they were all sleeping. Something Dorf, was it?
Nimmersdorf, yes.
Yeah, you talk about that they didn't know what was about to rain upon them, you know? And what was, why was this second wave attack, this vicious attack done? What was it about the German culture that they just wanted to stamp out? What was done there?
Quite honestly, the only explanation I can come up with is this Jewish hatred for anyone who would stand up against them and actually put them in concentration camps, would dispossess and disenfranchise them, as occurred in the 30s, that the hatred was so deep,
venomous,
that there was even killing was too much. It was treating the Germans too well to just kill them outright. Let them suffer. Let them, let their women folk be raped right in front of them. Let this go on and on, because now we can do it. We've got the power behind us. We can do anything we want. We're going to let our innermost,
demons.
We're going to let that evil, that vicious depravity, we're going to give it free rein. It can go anywhere it wants. And it's going to be a pleasurable thing. We're going to pay them back. That's all I can come up with.
Well, in your book, Tom, in the early stages, you mentioned Ben Heck and Theodor Kaufmann, who were responsible for the propaganda against Germany, and they were using words like total annihilation, perish forever, never reproducing, etc., etc. And these were the words printed in the Jewish media virtually all over the world. And
demonized Germany,
It's just demonizing. And the interesting side that I found earlier in some of the readings I did was that the German people accepted the Jews openly. Mm-hmm. They brought them in and they accepted them openly. This is going way back, but they weren't racist against the Jewish people. And this is the crazy part of why did the Jews develop this bitter hatred against the people of Germany when it wasn't the people of Germany that did anything to them? That's what I can't understand. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult question, isn't it? It's a difficult era.
Yeah, you know, it is. And I would almost like to have a Jewish opinion on this. Why, if we could find somebody that could keep their composure and not just start with the rants, because I agree with you. They had lived together fairly well for hundreds of years. Now, the sudden rupture and the sudden disenfranchisement, this forcing Jews from positions they had worked and earned in their minds. Now, that's got to make any people extremely angry, but not to the depth of this, not to the degree of the depravity that was wreaked upon Germany. I mean, this is off the charts. This is so vile and vicious that, yes, I mean, this is, I can say this, and I should have said this earlier, that I'm an expert on this book, but take me beyond the book, talk about World War II or talk about the first 500 years of modern Jewish history, and I really don't know. I don't know that much about the Jewish relationship with Germany and Weimar Republic and so on. And so I ask questions just like anybody else. The book I'm an expert on. I know where I'm going with this. But the rupture and the embarrassment, the shame, must have been so great among these Jews that were forced to leave to America, Canada, Australia, to the Soviet Union, must have been so... It must have hurt them so deeply. And, you know, that's all I can come up with, because nobody but somebody from hell would do the things they did once they got back into Germany.
Well, it seems to go way back. Tom, like, just very briefly, when you look at the history of the Roman Empire in the Middle East, and you see when they eventually, it was around about, I think, 60 AD, when they totally and absolutely annihilated Jerusalem because of the problem with the Jews. So it's a long story with them when they go through Europe and they spread out, and when they went into Germany and Spain and into America now. I mean, the destruction in America because they did the same things in Germany. They used to loan to the farmers and then end up taking their farms, and they took control of the banking. All these sorts of things happen in every country they've been because they're middlemen. But certainly, like what you said, how could you, even if you were booted out of a country for doing these things, and, you know, people don't want foreigners coming in controlling their farms. We've got the same problem here in Australia. We're against it. But how it can create that massive hatred to do what they've done to Germany was absolutely mind-blowing. And it's something I'd like to understand more myself, but it's only people like yourself who are bringing this out into the open where it can be discussed.
Maybe, Garth, as well, they feed the German people, because you look at the Germans, they're so incredible. Everything they make is amazing, even right down to beer, Tom. Garth and I enjoy German beer because it's so pure, and they actually have a German purity law of 1516. To make sure that their beer and their food and everything was made perfectly. No genetically modified products in their beers, generally pure spring water. That's just beer, and that's the only law in the world like it. And the cars, everything that Germans make and do is fantastic. And I think maybe there may have been a mindset there as well within these creatures that did this, that they knew the potential maybe of the German people, and they didn't want them to be like a bigger superpower. So that was another way to completely destroy them also.
Yes, I think what you're saying... am I still coming through okay on
Perfect.
This mic?
Yeah.
What you've said I had never thought of before. I should have, but I hadn't. I agree. This could be some real fierce competition in the future. So while we've got the chance, let's try to destroy it utterly.
Yeah.
And, of course, the plans were to destroy Germany utterly. The Morgenthau plan, Morgenthau was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's treasury, Secretary of Treasury, and that was his plan, basically to pastoralize Germany after the war, which would result, of course, in roughly three-fourths or two-thirds of the German population dying if it was turned into nothing but an agrarian society. That is, closing down all the factories, all the mills, closing the mines, stopping the railroads, basically turning Germany into some kind of Romania.
But they were building, and, weren't they? Yeah.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. But this degree of hatred, it's, I don't know. And I'll tell you what, I assume that the most recent excess committed by Israel, this so-called war in Gaza, which actually was, you know, calling that a war is like calling a massacre, a misunderstanding. This was a this was a genocide.
They say it's like the world heavyweight fighter taking on a baby in a match.
That's pretty close to it, yes. but, you know, I understand there must have been some terrible atrocities committed in that. There's nobody reporting, of course.
No.
But shooting kids on the beach playing soccer, for God's sakes, that's an atrocity. Mm. But the degree of hatred for the Germans, you know, they had, like we said before, they had lived together for hundreds of years. Certainly there was some understanding or some warmth and love, and I'm certainly not bringing it out in my book, but somebody probably should. Maybe we can understand this better, because I cannot believe that all Jews hated all Germans and vice versa. I know what was at stake here. I know exactly what was at stake. It was either going to be Germans for Germany or Germany for Germans, or, you know what I'm trying to say, or it's going to be totally dominated by Jews, because that's the way it is in America today. We have a nation totally usurped by the Jewish power structure, the power grid, not only in U.S. government, but in media, academia, culture, art, so-called art. We are no longer the keepers of our home, and I'm assuming that was very similar to Weimar Germany. In other words, if Americans could, tomorrow, we would vote unanimously to stop illegal aliens crossing our border. And what's more, I think a clear majority would vote to expel those who are already here, hanging around and committing crimes, gangs. But we're not in control of our country. The same crowd that gave Benjamin Netanyahu standing ovation, I think 13 standing ovations.
How many got?
26, I think it was.
26.
20? Well, I mean, they're no better than a group of trained SEALs. They no more represent us than would trained SEALs. And, of course, they are trained SEALs. They're Israeli trained SEALs, because that's who's paying their pocket. That's who's lining their pockets. So we Americans, and I'm assuming the Aussies are very similar to our situation. You know, a few years back, a few decades back, actually, Americans were starting to move to Australia because America had been desegregated. The blacks were being turned loose on our schools and our cities. People were fleeing the cities. And those who didn't were going to Australia, some of them. I don't know if they were stupid. I guess they figured that Australia was totally white and would stay white. You would always have patriotic leaders. Well, you know, for the last 20 years, I know who you've had to lead you, and they've been your worst enemies, actually.
Yes, that's
just,
for sure.
Just like in America. But anyway, I do digress. I go down rabbit trails.
We love that here. plunging down the rabbit hole.
rabbit holes.
Let me say a few other things about the book. I think I should. How much time do we still have?
Plenty of time.
Yeah, 10 minutes or so.
Oh, really? Well, I better say just a few things here about the book.
We can go about another 10, 20 minutes. That's fine, Tom.
It's up to you guys. But anyway, the book is more than just about rape and terror bombing. For instance, how many of the listeners know that at the end of the war occurred the greatest nautical disasters in world history?
It wasn't that's fascinating.
It is. Lusitania, nope. Titanic, nope. These were German refugee ships trying to escape the Soviet army that was closing in on the east. And so by the thousands, men, women, and children tried to get on these ships, these freighters. And sometimes they were old passenger liners that had been used for just getting people back and forth. The Soviet submarines just had a field day, a turkey shoot. They were sinking these ships, and they knew exactly who they were. They knew they were refugee ships because there were no longer any German naval vessels of any size on the Baltic. But the Wilhelm Gustloff, it was sunk with roughly 7,000 people dying in that one sinking alone, mostly women, old people, and children. The General Steuben, I think 5,000. The Goya, 6,000. We're talking a Baltic massacre. killing people in this icy, frozen Baltic Sea. I'd never even heard of that until I started doing the research. But things like also, we Americans, we like to think we're just good-natured people, especially in war. We seem to be the only people who actually are civil, that we treat our prisoners correctly, that we give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, that's BS.
The bubble gum, yeah.
Bubble, yes, yeah. Americans.
The old G.I. Joe there, helping everybody, yeah.
Having, you know, patting little children, giving them Hershey bars. Americans were taking no prisoners, virtually no prisoners.
Incredible.
People tried to surrender after D-Day as Americans rolled through France and Germany. They were mowing people down right and left. One of the, one account I do chronicle in the book was the Dachau massacre after Americans came in, filled their heads filled with propaganda, of course, Jewish propaganda about the so-called death camps, the killing of Jews. When they came into Dachau and they found, indeed, railroad cars filled with bodies stacked like cordwood, they thought, aha, the propaganda is not propaganda, it's truth. And so what they did was line up the camp guards, roughly 500 young SS soldiers, young and old SS. The camp guards themselves had fled when they heard the Americans were coming. But the camp these SS soldiers took command to hand it over orderly to the Americans. Well, the Americans turned the camp inmates loose on the Germans and let them kill as many as they wanted with knives, with shovels, beating them to death. And then the roughly about, 400 or 500 that were left, they were lined up against a wall and machine gunned to death. And this was captured on film, by the way. But 500 German soldiers massacred in one fell swoop, one spot, the Dachau massacre. And as we know, I've told you already, and that nothing is moving in Germany, that it's very difficult for cities, towns, farms to find food in the wintertime like this, much less medicine. So the concentration camps are the first people to feel this policy of targets of opportunity, of shooting anything that moves. And yes, you're going to have people die. It will happen the same way in Australia and America. I guarantee you, if they ever get in a similar situation that Germany found itself, fighting for survival, fighting tooth and nail, fighting to hold back the forces of the world, believe me, we will have concentration camps. And if the enemy gets control and starts shooting up our railroads and our boats and stuff, we will starve too. Believe me, the first people that are going to starve to death are the ones that are in the concentration camps. That is the communists, the people who, the subversives, the people that the Germans found they had to put in the concentration camps, just like any other nation would. This isn't just feel good stuff like, hey, let's take this group, let's take these homosexuals over here, let's put them in prison. No, the Germans had to do this because they were in a fight for survival, and these people were potential fifth columnists. So that's what America, that's what Australia will do if we're in a similar situation. It's human nature. But anyway, after the war was over, something Americans have been doing for quite a while didn't begin with World War II, but it certainly got a head of steam, and that's torture. Torture for torture's sake, having fun with it. A lot of your listeners probably remember those vicious, depraved photographs of Americans mugging it up in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq with these helpless, naked Iraqi men laying on the floor being attacked by dogs and shocked by probes on their bodies, and how these vicious, depraved creatures were laughing and smiling and mugging it up for the camera. The Americans were doing the same thing in World War II.
Yeah.
In fact, if you can imagine, with every American unit coming in, there were Jews. There were Jews that had fled Germany when Hitler came to power, that went to America. Well, guess what? These guys are perfect to come in as G2. That's G2 stands for intelligence. In other words, Army intelligence. To come in, they speak German well. They understand German culture. They understand German minds. And let's face it, they've got a grudge to bear against the Germans. So these people were turned loose. And honestly, let's face it, if somebody's torturing you, you will tell them anything they want to hear. if they're squashing your testicles flat, if they're poking things under your fingernails, if they're tormenting you with fire, eventually you're going to say anything they want to hear. And that's the case here. It was just old-fashioned medieval fun with torture, and that's all it was. There were hardly anything gained from this type of torture, but by the tens of thousands, the former Nazi party members, soldiers, officers, even just normal civilians, like Leni Riefenstahl, probably the greatest filmmaker in the world at the time. Leni Riefenstahl, a lady, a beautiful woman, were tortured, raped, brutalized. It's one of the nastier aspects of this because it hurts so deeply. When I was in the military, I don't want to, let me say this, I think perhaps you either have a soul or you don't have a soul, but it seems like when you're 18 years old, you even have less of a soul if you happen to be born with one. And so it's easier to do terrible things. Yeah. It's not so easy when you become 35 or 45 and think about what you've done.
Yeah, you haven't developed properly yet. Yeah.
Yeah, but at this age, you're capable of a lot of things. And the people who did these tortures, let me say this. Okay, this is probably a pretty good time to say this. I've been coming down pretty hard on the Jews. What kind of people would listen to such propaganda, such outrageous propaganda? And what kind of people would actually do these deeds that these people are demanding? What kind of people are we if we just so easily allow ourselves to become the willing instrument of Jewish hatred? What does that say about us? Are we any better? I think not. We must be dumb as cattle. We must be the dumbest things on earth. Again, we're young soldiers doing this, but what does that say about us? Maybe we're no better than they are. I've often said, and you know, if you really want to know who the problem is, just look in the mirror. And I'm talking to, you know, white people, Christians, when I say that, because if we had our intelligence, if we had our spirit, our strength back, if we had our dignity, we would never allow this to happen. We would, for instance, today, the Scandinavians are some of the greatest people we still have. They have this high moral standard that seems to be missing in a lot of white people elsewhere. They seem to have this built-in moral compass. Many of us of European blood have forgotten that they do know right from wrong. They will stand up. Let me give you an example. This happened in Paris. I was there when my child was 11 years old. We were going through Euro Disney. I was just with my son, just running around Europe, doing this and that. But we were standing in line, and it was hot in Paris, standing in line for Euro Disney, waiting for a ride. And there were these characters. There was a guy and a gal, pretty big people, actually. And they were line crowding. They were moving ahead ever imperceptibly, trying to get ahead of the next person very slowly, acting like they weren't doing it, but we could tell they were, and we're all hot and miserable. Well, guess who was right behind them who saw every bit of this? It was one of the biggest Scandinavian guys you would ever see in your life. He had to be 6'7", 6'8", and built like a building. Him and his girlfriend, finally, this guy had had enough watching these clowns do this, and he stopped him right there. He said, "No, you don't," in English. "You go back. You go back." In other words, so many of us were just willing to let this go on. Yeah. This dude was not. Believe me, he would have killed this guy. But that's what I mean about the moral compass, the rectitude in their carriage. I don't know. Maybe only Americans are capable of such vicious acts as these. Even the Russian boys have an excuse, in my opinion. And, you know, we have a tendency to get down on the Russians for being innately primitive or depraved or whatever. Well, who wouldn't be after you've had your country bled white by the Bolsheviks? I was in Russia a couple of months ago, and I met some of the nicest people on earth, trust me. And there's an account in my book also. There's not much good in this book, quite honestly. There aren't very many good moments, but there is this account of this German who is in Siberia being worked to death for about the 10th year of his captivity after the war is over, and he has nothing, of course. He's about ready to die, I think. But something that finally gave him reason to live was this pathetic old babushka, this Russian grandmother, who was dressed in rags on her way to church. And she felt so sorry for him, she actually, a tear came down her cheek when she saw this poor German even worse off than she was. And she opened his hand and put her hand on him and closed it again. And when she left, he looked down and it was a ruble. And that moved him so much he had reason to live again, because he thought the whole world was against him, that hated him. But moments like that, the Russians are just in the same position the rest of us are right now. Although they seem to have their priorities going fairly straight now with Putin. But anyway, there I go down that rabbit trail again. the book is meant to make people angry. The book is designed to wake people up and say, we have this in the English language, you have this saying that, if you don't learn from your history, you're doomed to repeat it over and over and over again. Well, you know, we didn't learn from what we're talking about tonight, about World War II history, what really happened, the hellstorm. We didn't learn about it because there was this aura of the silence that shrouded World War II. We only got what the victors wanted us to hear. The Jewish communications, the media moguls. We got the good war. We got the greatest generation. And so therefore, you see that we're repeating World War II all over again. We're headed that way again toward World War III. We have not learned. We're committing some of this. Let's put it this way. America has been in a nonstop war for about the last 20 years, a nonstop rolling war. We have right now, we're bombing. Somebody decided we're bombing six countries right now as we speak.
Yes,
we're bombing six.
Yeah.
Yeah, bombing six countries. We're trying to egg on Putin and Russia right now in Ukraine, in the eastern part, that we're, for reasons I have no idea, because these two nations are capable of destroying the world tomorrow morning. I mean, there will be nothing tomorrow if they went at war with each other. And so if I would think that if we had known what happened in World War II, had we known of some of the things we've talked about tonight and a thousand more things that we could have talked about, had we known how vicious, how depraved, how bloody, how evil this war was, I think if the world had known about this, there would have been a concerted effort to stop war forever. And the people would have said with a united voice, never again will this happen. Not in our name, not in our time. It may happen 100 years from now, but not in our time, I guarantee you. But yes. we didn't learn that history because it was the silent treatment. Now, 70 years later, comes a little book by an unknown person like myself, and that's not good enough. People like you are getting the word out, though. And so more and more people are hearing about this. But is it too late? Have we gone too far down that path? Because let's face it, America has become nothing but a stooge, a pit bull of Israel. Israel will fight to the last American. It's the Jewish wars, yep. And American body bags. It's as simple as I can make it. Israel wants somebody taken out, whether it's Saddam Hussein or somebody in Yemen, and we do it. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And so we have been usurped, our government, and we're nothing but a proxy right now, a pit bull, if you will, of Israel. That's something else. I don't think people would have allowed that if they had known who was responsible for the crimes committed against Germany in this war. But so we're spitting in the wind right now, my friends, and yet there's no other solution. There's nothing else we can do but try to fight and try to light a fuse under the world. And I believe, you know, I get very, unlike everybody else, I think, who knows the truth of what's going on in this world, you get very depressed. You think, I feel like a midget facing, a redwood tree. I mean, I can't move this mountain. I can't move this sea. I can't bail out the water. What can I do? You do the best you can.
Yeah, I think
you
also,
just don't,
also
told you don't roll over.
Yeah, and Americans need to start getting positive because, you know, we do all look at America. Australia and America have a very close relationship, and we look at America as a big brother, you know what I mean? And if the change is going to come, it's going to come from there. And, you know, that's for sure. And I think it's a sleeping giant. And I hope so much that the American people wake up and see what's going on here. And we're looking at $8 million a day to Israel from America. And this is from Stop the Blank Check. And they're saying on average, Israelis receive 7,000 times more U.S. foreign aid per capita than any other people in the world. And Israel is one of the world's most affluent nations. And they're saying American taxpayers have given more money to Israel than any other nation, despite being the smallest and one of the richest countries in the world. And we're looking at a whopping $8.5 million a day from the U.S., going to that country. And we heard a World Bank whistleblower say that there's literally trillions of dollars being siphoned out of America, and it's all going to London, and it's being divided up between the Vatican, the rich bankers over there, Israel, and black operations. So the American people, as they go down and down into the toilet, you know, they have to wake up and see what's going on here. Why do they keep supporting Israel? Why are they being Israel's little bitch? And they also don't just fight these wars for Israel, they're cleaning the mess up as well and copping all the blame, while Israel gets off scot-free all the time because everyone's thinking the Americans are the bad guys, which they are. All of them are to blame. But no one's looking at Israel. And the money is astounding, Tom, that's going out of America to Israeli pockets from the taxpaying Americans as their economy, their manufacturing, car industries, everything goes shipped offshore, and they have less and less money. And American men end up wandering around in this limbo state for years and years just to find a simple job, you know?
Agreed. Everything you've said is true. You left out people like Germany, though, that have given trillions more to Israel.
Yes, well.
Reparations.
Yes, we had our foreign minister, Tom, Bob Carr. He was our former foreign minister. He's just written a new book. His name's Bob Carr, and he's come out and said that Australia's foreign policy is completely controlled by Israel. Completely controlled. And our current prime minister is an Israeli bootlicker. And he came out and said that Australia is like Israel, and it just absolutely is disgusting and offended very deeply people like myself and Garth for him to say that we're like Israel, we're nothing like them. And here they are, Australia are going over to these wars with America now. And, you know, this is new for Australia, and I see Australia going down a dark path here. And we are controlled, and it's very, very scary. And we're seeing all our industry, Tom, our cars now, it's all being shipped off to China and India and these countries. Our manufacturing's pretty much gone. The Chinese are buying up all our milk and dairy and farmlands, all our wheat, everything. And people have to wake up and see this and say no, stamp their feet and say no, you know, no more.
As you said, get angry,
get angry, Tom.
When you look at the reparations, that's absolute theft.
It's just unbelievable.
From Germany. Yeah. Unbelievable. They had to pay that money for all those years, and they're still paying it.
Still going.
I don't know. You know, if there's an uprising, boy, it's going to be a big one.
My sense in America, at least, and Europe, for the most part, is that those who still adhere to the party line are the older, aging generation, the younger people coming on, the internet generation, the people who were raised on that. This is going to be a different crew that comes along. I don't think there's enough propaganda, enough Jewish media to hold this crew in. They're too curious. They know things are bad. They know things are wrong. And that's where people like you come in. They may not all agree with everything we say, but that's cause for hope in the future.
Well, they're just expecting us, Tom, to sit down and watch pornography on the internet and go on to Zuckerberg's Facebook and tell everybody what we're doing every second of the day. And as I said, Garth and I are nobodies. We're just here doing a podcast, and we're talking to you now because we want to get off our hands and we want to do something and talk. And that's what so many people are scared to do today, Tom, and it's right down to an individual level. The average Joe Blow in his house in the suburbs with his children and family, he's scared on an individual basis, particularly because of all the fines now, right down to council and city council levels, where if you do anything, you get fined, and they just don't want to talk. They don't even want to talk around the water cooler at work anymore. They don't even want to have a whinge or a rant or talk to anyone. They're too scared that they're going to get a fine or something's going to happen to them. And that that's classic divide and conquer, and that's what the Jews do so well. And they separate us on an individual basis from everyone else. And what we're doing today is linking hands with you, and we hope that this just starts spreading, and everyone gets a podcast, and everyone writes a book, and everyone writes a paper, and buys your book, and starts making comments, and starts sharing books. Even start a book club is a good idea once a week or once a month, where people can go in and share their ideas in their books, and you know, talk to their families and their friends at work, and they start buying the books. That's where the ideas start. And if we all sit on the couch and just watch TV with drool coming out of the side of our mouth with a can of Pepsi in our hand watching American sitcoms, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, like a cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, instead of, I've heard a lot of people talk about waking up the mass and getting enormous numbers of people on our side. And I generally, that's something nice to work for, but it never has happened yet. And I don't think it ever will. I think what we have to do is what you're doing right now. You're energizing those who already have this curiosity, those who already know something's bad. I don't think you're ever going to get the people off the sofa. During the American Revolution, as a matter of fact, I think it was only something like 6% of the colonists were actually in the war itself, actually believed in the war and fought in the war. And another, I think, 13% indirectly supported them. The rest, the 80-some other percent, it's just like we have today, sitting on the couch more or less, drinking their Pepsi, if you know what I'm saying. And so if we can energize this intelligent, curious cadre, core of people that are out there, trust me, they are out there. I've gotten numerous emails from people you wouldn't even believe. Then I think that's what we have to do, because I've got to tell you, in the last 2 years, I have met some of the most incredibly talented, intelligent people on our side. Some people you'd be very surprised who are on our side. There is no time right now, of course, to stand up. In other words, we have to keep doing what we're doing. We're in no position to seize control of any government anywhere. In fact, I hope it never comes down to something violent. I hope it's something that occurs just like the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. I hope it's something that crumbles over under its own weight. And I got news for you guys. I think that's the way this is going to play out.
Yeah.
I think you will see a retrenchment initially, and then you'll see some things happen that probably will shock you. But that's where we come in. We've got to have a strong, cohesive group of people that know exactly where they're going and what they want. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. We have to know what we have to do. And so that this never happens again. Mm. Can you imagine something, we do this, and then 100 years later, our ancestors, our descendants, they face the same damn problem. We have to make sure this time that nothing like this ever happens again, where we lose control of our lives, where we become virtual slaves, where we're begging for peanuts more or less right now. I just got to say thanks to you guys, the people just like you that have the guts, the courage, the wherewithal, and the time, or make the time to come out and do this, because I got to believe you're lighting some fires under people now in Australia. It sounds like a good program, a good thrust. And
it's out there, Tom, and it is pretty much a mind war, and that's where they're getting us, through our minds. And you know, books like yours, it acts like a key to those who are ready to receive that information. Those who are searching for knowledge, they get a book like yours, and it just acts like a key, and it just opens up doorways within people, within us. It already has with me. And you know, people need to take this knowledge and read this book, and it's a positive thing, because we can't fix, you know, anything that's happening now or anything that's going to happen unless we understand what they did and what happened. And it can happen again. Look at the camps all across America, you know, these FEMA camps and stuff. There's something eerie going on this planet. And, you know, you can feel that there's something very, very dark on this planet. And it's a mind war against us. And we can all do it together. There's nothing to fear, because that's what they feed on, isn't it, Tom? They feed on fear, and they keep us down on our knees, and that's how they do it. Fear, 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 fear. Everyone's living in fear. We can't think straight, and we can't get our lives straight and in order when we're living in fear, you know?
Well, yes, everything you're saying, I agree with. I've passed through the same, I've crossed the same lines that you guys have. I suppose I came to a point in my life where I thought, I want to go out. When I finally die, I want to say I did the best I could.
Yeah.
I don't want to go on like I'm doing now. Basically, going along to get along, keeping my mouth shut when I knew what the truth was right now. And I have to attribute this to the internet age. People right now have the power of every library on earth at their fingertip. I mean, man, I remember the bad old days when you had to trudge around to libraries and then write letters with stamps, like sending smoke signals that took forever to get stuff back. This is not it. This is the day of the information. This is the information age. And so anybody now that refuses to, has no curiosity and refuses to learn or find out what's ahead, all I can say is I'm sorry, you're not going to be around much longer, truly. You need to arm yourself. And I have to say this, unless you know where we've been and what may be ahead for us, you're not totally armed. Unless you, when you guys finish this book, I've had people tell me this, more than one person, by the way, dozens of people say that they never see the world in the same way after they've read this book. It's changed everything. Yeah. Yeah. Not just politically, but how they view their future, how they view the future of Earth. They say that once you read this book, you are transformed. You become different. I have to say that. Well, imagine me. I researched. I wrote and rewrote and rewrote again the book. So I'm just like anybody else. I was transformed. I'm a different person. I'm not any longer afraid of death. No. I'm not afraid. I don't want to die, but I'm not afraid of it anymore. There are worse things. As you know, when you read this book, there are worse things than death. I'm afraid of that, but I'm not afraid of dying. So from here on, I will speak my mind. I will say what I have to say and let the chips fall where they may.
Okay, Tom, we come to Excellent. The end, Garth. Yeah, and people can just really look at the powerful cover of Hellstorm. If you look at the anguish on the cover, isn't it, Tom? It's the lady's face on the cover of that book, and it's these poor people in our hearts and our minds, and go out to the German people who lost their lives there, and it's such a sad thing, and it's a hard book to read for folks, but it needs to be read, and people need to get this book, Tom Hellstorm. Just before we go, Tom, with you, what's a good way? I know it's a bit hard for Australians to get your book directly from you, so I'd say for Australians, when you listen to this podcast, you can get Tom's book, Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, from Amazon. That's probably the best place, and you can get it on Kindle and hardcover. And for Americans, Tom, they can send you an email and you can send them out a copy, can't you?
Yes, I sell a paperback for $20, and anyone who has PayPal can just drop that $20, that's including postage, into my PayPal account, which is M.T. Goodrich, as M as in Michael, T and Thomas, Goodrich, at AOL.com, and I'll have a book in the mail for them tomorrow. I'm sorry to say that the folks in Australia, the postage costs more than the book.
About $22. If someone wants to support, someone wants to get that book and get you to send it to them, and they're in Australia, it'll be about $42, and I think that's still okay. The postage is a bit much, but I think most people have Kindles and will go on Amazon and get that book, and I just so much recommend it. Garth and I have just got ours. I'm already hooked, and I said that at the start. I know it's a heavy read, Tom, but I can't. It's the way that you write, and you don't cut any corners, and there's no bullshit in this. It's right in your face, and we need to understand what happened in our past. We really need to front up and start looking at ourselves, as you said, in the mirror, and see who we are, and we need to take this information and assess it. And then I think, as you said, Tom, when people read this book and they finish it, they will want to make sure that this never happens again, ever in our history. And if enough of us start thinking like this, we can bring this system down. As you said, it will crumble because they're feeding on fear, and we need to turn this into love. And we need to use this negativity that happened in our past and turn it into a really positive thing, a loving thing, and all stand together and get this done. But it's a great book. I'm sure Garth is right into it. And yep. It's just so great to talk to you today and for you to come on and chat with us. And we'd love to have you on again soon for a bit of a chat on what's happening in today and in the news and anything like that you want to talk about. We're here every Thursday, so it'd be great to get you on again soon and have a chat.
I'd be happy to do it, you guys. You're fun, and we're both on the same page, obviously.
That's why it's great, yeah.
Yeah, and let me also encourage folks that do have the book or will get the book that when you're through with it, please don't just put it up on your shelf and
share
let
it
gather dust. Share it.
Yeah,
pass it around.
Sharing.
There are some people that will never accept the book because they refuse to believe it or don't want to accept the reality of it all. But those people that you think might, try it. See if they do. Because this is the reality gut check time. This is what we're facing. This is what our people faced back then when they were fighting for us, and this is also what we're going to be facing, I guarantee you. So please pass that book on. And again, guys, this was a lot of fun. You bet. If we can get the time straight here. You guys are in mourning, or were in mourning, and I'm in...
We're Thursday the 25th, Tom, and it's about midday, 12:09 here. So generally, if we talk to you, it'll probably be the same time, around 10 a.m. here.
That will work for me, let me tell you. This is not work. It's not fun either, but it's necessary. And guys, anytime you want me, I'm here.
Yeah, I'll keep in contact with you, and it's fantastic. And all the young people out there, don't go to the movies and hire DVDs of horror movies. Go and read this book, because this is the horror. This is real, and it happened, and you need to read this, because you're getting screwed up watching these horror movies. That's not real. This is real. This is what was done to the German people, and it's a fantastic book, Tom, and you're a great writer. And, so everyone, please go out. The Kindle's only $9.55, and the hardcover's $25 from Amazon. Go and get yourself a copy of Hellstorm. By Thomas Goodrich, and please read this book. And books are for sharing. Share it with everyone you know, and anyone you think might want to research this, give it to them. And let's wake up out of this trance and limbo state and start realizing what's been done to us in the past and what's being done to us now and what will be done to us unless we wake up and see what's going on, Tom. So thanks for joining us, Tom, and just stay there. We'll say goodbye to you and we'll finish up. Anything you want to finish on, Garth?
No,
all good.
You've said it all there,
yeah,
and great to talk to you, Tom.
Well, it's been my pleasure, guys, and I'll just simply say good night from America, and to all my Aussie brothers and sisters, keep the faith, keep fighting, never give up. I love you all. Thank you.
Okay, ciao, people, and please get this interview out to everyone that you know, and we'll see you next Thursday.